Catherine Tegan Books and Harper Audio present The Box in the Woods by Maureen Johnson. Performed by Kate Rudd. The investigator must bear in mind that he has a twofold responsibility: to clear the innocent as well as to expose the guilty. He is seeking only the facts, the truth in a nutshell. Francis Glessner Lee. July 6th, 1978, 11:45 p.m. Sabrina Abbott was doing something illegal. Impossible. Sabrina had never done anything illegal. She was Barlow Corner's paragon of virtue, the valedictorian, the library volunteer who read to children, the person who hyperventilated for 10 minutes when she accidentally skipped a class because she was too deep in her research at the school library, the one who every parent of a younger student pointed to and said, "Be like Sabrina when you get to high school." What would they say now if they saw her in Todd Cooper's notorious brown Jeep as it bounced down the dirt road through the woods, juddering as the tires made contact with the many pits and bumps along the way? The green fuzzy dice hanging from the rearview mirror banged together from the impact, almost in time with the Led Zeppelin pulsing from the stereo. The headlights were the only thing that cut through the dark between the trees and the sky with its sliver of a moon. Sabrina didn't particularly like or trust Todd, who was the captain of the football team and the son of the mayor. Todd was an asshole, but he came with the package tonight. He had the car. Here she was, breaking camp curfew and going into the woods, both prohibited activities. But those infractions were nothing compared to what they were going to do once they reached their destination. She pressed herself into her companion's side. Eric Wilde was her new... Was he her boyfriend? They hadn't gotten that far yet in the discussions. She had no doubt that he wanted that title, and she had just freed herself from her boyfriend of 3 years. No need to rush back in. It was time for the new Sabrina. The one who lived, who did things, who didn't worry so much. This good girl needed a break. The last few weeks had shown her that.
"You okay?"
Eric said over the music. "Yeah," she replied. A bug flew in her mouth as she did so, and she picked it out. Was she okay? Her worries were still there, nibbling at the edge of all her thoughts. She tried to shut them out. That's what tonight was for, breaking the spell of fear.
"Sure?"
"Just cold," she said. That much was true. It was cool tonight, especially as the top was off the Jeep. She was only wearing shorts and a green Camp Wonder Falls t-shirt. Regular Sabrina would have been more prepared and brought a sweatshirt. New Sabrina was going to be cold. Eric wrapped his arm around her and drew her close. His blonde curls tickled her nose as she leaned into his shoulder. The Jeep pulled off the path and stopped off to the side, under the cover of a small group of trees. The music cut out, and the four passengers stepped out of the vehicle. "This is it?" Sabrina asked.
"Not here," said the girl in the passenger seat. "Close, though, we have to walk."
The girl's name was Diane McClure, and she was a fellow recent graduate of Liberty High. Diane was a tall redhead with freckles clustered all over her body. She and Sabrina had never been in the same orbit at school. Sabrina led the class in academics. Diane seemed to spend most of her time leaning against lockers and hanging out in the smoking lounge. She was the kind of person Sabrina's parents told her to avoid. But she wasn't a bad person. Sabrina had come to like her company. She was loyal, hardworking in her own way, and school wasn't for everyone. Diane was Todd's girlfriend and probably Todd's only redeeming feature. Sabrina climbed out of the back of the Jeep, which took a little doing, as they had packed it with several bags of supplies, several of which hampered her exit.
"It's this way,"
Eric said, taking Sabrina's hand in his.
"Let me guide you, my dear. Never fear, never fear. Into the woods we go."
Diane and Eric both had powerful flashlights,
but their beams barely penetrated the dark between the trees. Sabrina had lived in Barlow Corners all her life, and certainly had spent time in the woods, but never this deep in, and never at night. It was something you didn't do. The woods were dark and deep, full of creatures. "How far?" she asked, trying to make her voice light.
"We're almost there. Trust me, I come out here every week. I know the way," said Eric.
"I trust you," she said.
"You sure you're okay?"
Eric asked. "I'm sure, why?"
"You're kind of crushing my hand."
"Oh," she released her grip. "Sorry."
"It's okay, I have two. Actually, I have three, but that's because the experiment went wrong."
She laughed. That's what was great about Eric. He could make her worries vanish. Eric knew something about living, something she wanted to learn.
"I won't tell anyone," she said.
"Oh, good. I can't let them shut down my lab. Not when I'm so close. Soon my creation will come to life!"
He shouted that last word, causing something in the branches above to stir and fly off.
"Eric, you freak," Diane said, laughing.
"You say that like it's a bad thing," he replied. "And here we are."
The flashlight beams struck a small clearing. There were a few cut logs on the ground, rough seating around a stone circle.
"Okay," Eric said, setting down the bag he was carrying. "You guys do the setup. We'll go get the milk. This way, my dear, just over yonder a few paces."
Eric took her hand once again to guide her through the dark. They re-entered the woods on the other side of the clearing.
"So how do you pay for it?"
Sabrina asked, picking her way along the tangle of roots beneath their feet.
"What's the system?"
"If you continue to come with me on my magical journey, you will learn all, little Bilbo."
"Did you just call me Bilbo?"
"It's from The Hobbit."
"I know it is from, you moron," she said, laughing.
"Never question the girl who works in the library,"
Eric said, bowing low.
"I beg forgiveness."
Something crunched near them, and Sabrina let out an involuntary yip.
"It's fine," he said, shining the light around. "Lots of noises out here. They startle you at first."
Suddenly, she didn't want to be here. Her whole body flooded with anxiety. Eric seemed to sense this and stopped.
"It's cool,"
he said. "There's something out there."
"There probably is. A raccoon, a possum, a skunk. But they don't come near the clearing or the fire."
"You're sure?" she asked.
"I come out here every week. I always hear something. It's the woods. Seriously, they don't want to come near people. They stay away."
"I know, I need to relax. I'm trying."
"Here's the thing. You're trying to relax. You're even pushing yourself to do that. You push yourself too hard."
"I know, I know."
The world slowly righted itself. Sabrina took a deep breath and straightened up.
"Keep going," she said. "I'm fine."
They continued on another 50 paces or so, until the flashlight revealed a small structure. It was a box in the woods, about 8 feet long and 4 feet high.
"Here we are,"
Eric said, approaching it.
"What is this?"
"An old hunting blind,"
Eric replied, handing her the flashlight and lifting the large lid with both hands.
"Hunters would hide inside while they were hunting deer. It's got little openings in the side they could look out of."
"Creepy," she said. "But I guess hunting is creepy by definition. You creep behind animals to kill them."
"True. Anyway, this one hasn't been used in a long time."
That much was clear. While not completely rotted, the box was on the path in that direction. The boards were weather-worn and bowed, and some of them were coming away. It was now most likely home to spiders and snakes and various other critters, so she cringed a bit as Eric climbed inside and started rooting around in a pile of discarded wood. She made a mental note to check herself carefully for ticks when they got back to camp.
"Where is it? Where is it? Ah, here we go."
He stood up and proudly held aloft a crumpled McDonald's bag.
"That's it?"
Sabrina said. Eric climbed out of the box and closed the lid.
"Shine the light,"
he said. He set the bag down, opened it up, and removed a used Big Mac box, two hamburger wrappers, and a used cup, still with the straw.
"I can see you're not impressed," he said. "But Behold.
He opened the Big Mac box. The container was brimming with fresh, fragrant marijuana buds, as were the hamburger wrappers and the soda cup. Sabrina had seen marijuana before, small amounts of it usually in the form of joints, but she had never seen this much. This was an extremely illegal amount of marijuana, a scholastic career-ending amount, a definitely arrestable criminal record amount.
No one looks at trash, Eric said with a smile. Especially trash inside of something that also looks like trash, out in the middle of the woods. Pretty clever, wouldn't you say?
I guess.
You guess? I'll have to try harder. Come on, time to get to work.
Back in the clearing, things were looking much more inviting and cheerful. There was a fire going, and a camp lantern sat on one of the logs. Two sleeping bags had been unzipped and spread out as blankets, their soft plaid flannel insides resting upward. The portable tape player was piping more Led Zeppelin into the velvety darkness. They were Diane's favorite band. Sabrina didn't like them at all, but if you hung out with Todd and Diane, you had to get used to it. Todd and Diane were stretched out on one of the sleeping bags, munching on chips and staring up at the sky.
Behold, Eric said, brandishing the bag aloft. Your milkman cometh.
He cupped his free hand over his mouth and made the tooting sound of a triumphant horn. He and Sabrina sat down on the other sleeping bag, which had been opened up for them. Eric handed the bag to Diane, who set it down on a stolen dining pavilion tray. She moved the lantern a bit closer and dumped out the contents of the Big Mac box and picked through it expertly.
And now we roll,
Eric said, grabbing a handful of chips.
For rolling is a part of the service. First ones are always for us. No one beats Diane, she's a machine.
Diane was working smoothly, plucking the buds. In the space of only a few moments, she had rolled the first joint, which she passed to Eric. She kept right on rolling, her movements hypnotic. Eric put the joint between his lips and lit it, then took a long inhale and passed it to Todd. Todd did the same, and then passed it to Diane, who didn't look up from her efforts as she took her hit. It ended up with Sabrina, who took it and held it. She could hear the gentle sizzle of the paper.
You don't have to, Eric said. Totally up to you.
She had asked to come out here. She wanted to try something new, and there was no way she wanted to get to Columbia and be the only person in the entire freshman class who had never smoked a joint. This was the perfect place to try. No one around, with people she knew. She put it to her lips and inhaled, and promptly coughed it all out in a gagging, reflexive manner. She expected them to laugh at her, but no one did.
Happens to everyone the first time, Eric said. Try again. Slower. Hold it as long as you can.
She inhaled once more. The smoke was acrid and it burned a bit, but she held it for several seconds before coughing it out again, though less violently this time. After a moment, she felt a little change, an easing. Her attention locked onto the music. She suddenly needed it to be different.
Can we switch the tape? She asked.
Sure,
Eric said.
What do you want to hear?
Fleetwood Mac.
Can we change it? Eric asked. Put on Rumors.
There was a low groan of displeasure from the other couple.
Come on, Eric said, smiling. It's her first time. Let her pick the music.
Reluctantly, Diane dug around in the backpack and pulled out a cassette. She stopped the one that was playing and replaced it. The haunting jangle of the guitar and the heavy, slow beat of the drum echoed between the trees, mingled with the crackle of the fire. Sabrina rested against the log and let the music wash over her. This was her favorite album. She'd listened to it thousands of times, probably. She knew the lyrics back to front, but tonight they were especially clear. Running in the shadows, damn your love, damn your lies. Eric, she said. He leaned over and looked down at her. He had a nice face, a kind face. It loomed over her like the moon.
How you doing?
He asked. Damn your lies.
You got it.
Beyond them, out of the range of the glow of the fire, What was that thing moving between the trees? An owl? A raccoon? A witch that rang like a bell in the night, or a ghost, or... No, it was a bit of the potato chip bag, which had caught fire and floated up.
Excuse us,
Todd said as he and Diane peeled themselves off the ground and pulled their sleeping bag away. They went off toward the trees behind them and vanished into the dark. Sabrina strained to turn around and watch them go, then she looked back to Eric.
It's okay, Eric said. There's no pressure like that. We'll just hang here, eat chips, listen to some music.
Sabrina eased and tucked herself under Eric's arm, resting her head on his shoulder.
My throat is dry, she said.
Eric leaned up and retrieved a Coke, which he opened and passed to her. It was warm, but welcome, sliding down her throat, sticky and sweet, ungluing her lips. It tasted so good. She downed half the can in one go.
What do you think?
He asked. She responded by belching and bursting into laughter.
There we go, he said. That's what I like to hear. See? Everything's not so bad.
Things weren't so bad. They were inexplicably hilarious. She felt her muscles ease, and she settled back into the gentle puffs of the sleeping bag.
This is...
stoned? She said.
Yes, he said. Take it easy, listen to the music, nowhere to be and nothing to do. I'm going to take a leak, back in a second.
He pushed himself up off the ground and headed toward the trees. As he walked off, he tripped dramatically over a log and did a staggered, almost fall. It was clearly a fake out for her amusement, and she burst into laughter again. Then he stepped into the trees. Sabrina leaned back, her head against the log. She was surrounded by the long shadows, the veil of smoke that oozed along with the music like honey. If she closed her eyes, she knew everything would spin and the world would cease to make sense. It barely made sense as it was. The bass drum beat on this song was like a heartbeat. Thump, thump, thump. Break the silence, damn the dark, damn the light. It sounded so serious, being a member of Fleetwood Mac. She loved them. This album had given her so much solace this year, through all the terrible things that had happened. Things she was not, she reminded herself, going to think about now. She tried to focus her eyes over the corona of the campfire. Somewhere behind her, Diane and Todd were making a lot of noise, really getting into whatever they were up to. Thump, thump, thump. She stared at the tray full of little flecks of leaves and buds, at the bag of chips and the fire and the hook of a moon. So many things had been troubling her recently. Why had she let herself get so stressed? This was Barlow Corners, and the whole point of Barlow Corners was that nothing ever happened here, right? She realized the song had changed. Wait, this was Gold Dust Woman. That was four songs into the second side of the album. She hadn't even noticed the songs or the time go by. How long had it been? 10 minutes? Something like that? Why was she still alone?
Eric,
she called. No reply.
Eric,
she called again, louder this time. There was nothing aside from Stevie Nicks singing about the Black Widow and the Pale Shadow and the Dragon. The song increasing in intensity. Sabrina's body was heavy and the shadows were long, and when she tried to move, everything had a slow, syrupy quality. She elbowed her way over to the tape player and turned down the volume. All around her was silence.
Diane? Todd? Eric?
No one replied. One part of her mind tried to say that this was fine. Maybe Eric had gone back to the hunting blind. Diane and Todd were busy. The other, louder part of her mind told her that something was wrong. 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 She decided to listen to the second voice. Sabrina pulled herself up to her feet. The ground was both too close and much too far away, and her eyes were confused from staring at the fire and then going into darkness. She blinked to refocus and reached for the lantern. It probably wasn't cool to bug Diane and Todd now,
but she was going to do it anyway.
She lifted the light and peered around, then took a few uncertain steps in the direction she thought they had gone.
It took her a minute or two of fumbling in the dark, tripping over tree roots and stumbling over her own feet, before she finally saw them on the ground, pressed together.
"Hey," she said, stumbling forward.
"Hey, Eric is..."
They didn't sit up when she spoke. They didn't move at all. There was something in the way they were lying there that was unnatural. Her heart was doing something very bad, pushing too hard, sending gurgles of air and confusion through her body that bottled up in her neck. There were footsteps behind her. She turned. It wasn't Eric, as she somehow deep inside knew it wouldn't be.
The Student Sleuth of Ellingham Academy by Jermaine Batt. Most high school students have hobbies. Some play music, some play sports, some write or draw or make things. Stephanie Stevie Bell solves crimes. Stevie is a student at the exclusive Ellingham Academy outside of Burlington, Vermont. That storied institution opened by tycoon Albert Ellingham as a place of creative, playful learning. Ellingham has no tuition and no admissions policy. Students are admitted by presenting themselves and talking about their passions, interests, and skills. Ellingham accepts students who want to do or be something in particular and assists them in meeting that goal. This was the mission of the school when it opened in 1935. In 1936, it became the scene of one of the 20th century's most infamous crimes, when Iris Ellingham, Albert's wife, and Alice Ellingham, their daughter, were kidnapped on one of the local roads. A student, Dolores Dottie Epstein, also vanished from the school grounds. Iris's and Dottie's bodies would be found in the following weeks. Alice Ellingham was never seen again. The case is a favorite of true crime enthusiasts and the subject of countless articles, books, and documentaries. Stevie Bell applied to Ellingham with the stated goal of solving this case. It was a bold and possibly unachievable goal, but the school accepted Stevie and allowed her to have a shot. Weeks after arriving at Ellingham, her fellow classmate, online sensation Hayes Major, died in an accident. Once again, Ellingham was the scene of tragedy. Stevie Bell, the student sleuth, didn't think that Hayes' death was an accident. Two more people associated with the school would die in the weeks following. That's a lot of accidents and a lot of deaths. But Stevie was not deterred, even when the murderer projected a threatening message on her wall in the middle of the night. With the help of her friends, including the author of this article, she continued her investigation and discovered who was responsible. The culprit. Log in to continue reading.
1. Murder is wrong, of course. Stevie's future was predicated on that fact. She wanted to solve murders, not commit them. To solve them, you had to understand why they'd occurred.
Motive, that was the key. It was all about motive. Understand the reasons behind the act. What pushes another human being to that point of no return?
It has to be a strong impulse.
I'll have a pound of, is that, do you have low-sodium ham?
Yes, Stevie said, staring at the woman on the other side of the deli counter.
Which one is that?
It's the one marked low-sodium ham.
Where?
Stevie pointed at a round-edged rectangle of ham. The one with the card that read, low-sodium ham.
Oh, okay. I'll have a, I make it a half pound of that and a pound of... Do you have low-fat Swiss cheese?
Yes.
Where's that?
Stevie pointed at the cheese that was similarly marked.
Oh.
The low-fat Swiss cheese somehow disappointed. The woman bit her upper lip and consulted her phone.
The recipe says low-fat Swiss, but... Do you have low-fat provolone?
No, Stevie said.
Oh,
What were the murder statutes in Pennsylvania?
Surely there had to be something in there about people who came to the deli counter and stood there asking questions about things that were clearly written on signs, making 10 other people wait behind them.
It was the Friday evening shift, which meant people wanted their weekend lunch meat and deli stuff and they wanted to go home. And here was this woman, lost in the cabinet of wonders that was the deli counter.
"Do you have," the woman began.
"Lots of murder weapons at the deli counter, so many knives. The most dangerous thing was the meat slicer, but it would be hard to turn that into a murder weapon. Too heavy, and it had a safety guard. It could probably be done, though."
"I guess," the woman peered into the glass. "I mean, I guess I'll take the Swiss, the low-fat Swiss. A quarter, no, wait, I'm probably going to double it, so, well, a quarter would probably be fine, or..."
"You'd have to get someone into the feeding side of the slicer, really hold them in there. You could take off their fingers."
"Miss?"
Stevie snapped back. She had been staring at the slicer, shoving imaginary fingers into the opening.
"A quarter pound of the low-fat Swiss," the woman said again.
This was said with a bit of an edge to it, indicating that it was outrageous how Stevie had made this woman wait entire seconds. There was no recognition of all the time the woman had spent pondering her lunch meatorial thoughts. She saw the woman give a side eye to someone else in the line that said, "Can you believe the kind of person they hire here?" Stevie clenched her jaw and took the heavy brick of cheese from the refrigerated counter.
"Thin!"
the woman yelled. "Thin!"
Stevie considered the slicer again. Not the most elegant weapon, but it could get the job done. Fame is a fleeting thing. One minute, she was the student sleuth, celebrated on the internet for catching a killer at her exclusive boarding school. People wrote articles about her. She saw her face at the top of some news pages, her short blonde hair that she cut herself sticking up at weird angles, her face too round for the camera but normal in life, and her vintage red vinyl coat looking good. She'd finished out the school year a celebrity. She'd kept her school open and safe, and, though the world at large didn't know it, she'd solved one of the greatest cases of the last century. And then, the world moved on to the next shiny thing. Her name still popped up from time to time, but not as much, and then not really at all. Then she was home from school, back in the suburbs of Pittsburgh. Her Ellingham friends returned to their homes as well, all over the country. Her old job at the mall was filled, and she was super lucky to get this job at the grocery store 4 days a week, from 4 to 11. Stevie didn't mind the job so much, really. The first part of the evening was the most annoying, the 4 to 8 shift behind the deli counter. She liked putting things in order, filling containers, slicing, packing. Where the whole thing fell apart was when she had to deal with people. She learned a lot working with customers. She knew the person who would chat to her nonstop, the person who felt that they were entitled to her entire soul as she got them ham. She saw people stressing and straining, working out budgets in their heads. She learned that people really like American cheese and that she wasn't sure what American cheese even was. The second half of the shift was spent breaking down the salad bar. That was definitely the best part of the night. From that point onward, she usually didn't have to talk to customers anymore. While she technically wasn't supposed to wear earbuds while people were in the store, no one cared that much, especially if you were doing a job like this one where you didn't have to deal with people. She had a full hour and a half of a true crime podcast to listen to while she removed the steam trays, filled carts with the leftover vegetables and fruits, and cleaned up the weird gunk that was on the side of the industrial-sized salad dressing bottles. She was in the middle of dumping out the bloody remains of a tray of pickled beets when her phone rang.
"Hey," she said quietly.
"How's my princess?" David said.
"Still working, you talk."
"Well, I'm here in, I don't remember the name of the town. We had dinner at Cracker Barrel. And now I'm at the local firehouse helping run a raffle for a group of candidates in this area. If you play your cards right, there might be a basket full of lavender bath salts in your future. What do you have for me?"
"Do you like used potato salad?" she asked.
Stevie noticed her manager eyeing her curiously.
"Gotta go," she whispered. "I think they know I'm on the phone."
"Talk later. And remember, If these coasters I'm looking at are telling the truth, it's always 1 o'clock somewhere. Think about that for a while.
At 11, Stevie Bell, student sleuth and destroyer of salad bars, clocked out and stepped into the muggy night. Her mother's maroon minivan was there waiting by the curb. Stevie did not have a car of her own. That was definitely out of the Bell family's financial reach. Every night, one of her parents came to get her.
Have a good night?
Her mom asked as she got in the car. It was okay. I got the cheese you asked for.
American cheese, of course.
You talk to David tonight?
Her mom asked as they pulled out of the parking lot.
Uh-huh. How is he?
Fine, Stevie said.
He's a good one.
Historically, Stevie and her parents had not gotten along. She wasn't what they expected from a daughter. Daughters were supposed to like prom dresses and getting their hair done and shopping. Stevie assumed those things were all fine and good, but she didn't understand them, really. At least not in the way that you were supposed to understand them. She never once in her life felt the desire to dress up, do her hair and nails, accessorize. She stared blankly at Instagram ads for new makeup palettes that looked, to her eyes, exactly like every other makeup palette. The only clothing item she really adored was her vintage red vinyl raincoat from the 70s. She wore a lot of black because it suited her and it always seemed to go together. Sometimes she felt like she was missing a chip or a jean or something that made this all matter, but it never bothered her much. Before Ellingham, Stevie's lack of daughterly graces was a sticking point, but there had been peace in the household for months now, and not because Stevie had solved a murder. No, it was because she had a boyfriend, and not just any boyfriend. Stevie's boyfriend was David Eastman, who happened to be the son of Senator Edward King. Stevie's parents loved Edward King. That Edward King had recently been the subject of a major scandal and had to withdraw his bid for the presidency did not diminish their love for him. Like any true believers, they felt that the more Edward King was accused of wrongdoing, the more right he must be. The more it had to be someone else's fault. Her parents didn't know that David was the one who had gotten his father busted. They certainly didn't know that Stevie had seen the proof against Edward King with her own eyes. David had been pulled out of school when his father found out what he had done. He finished the school year remotely, then left home to work with a voter registration campaign that traveled around the country. This was why he didn't know what town he was in tonight, and why he was standing around at a Cracker Barrel with baskets full of lavender bath salts and coasters. The details of all this were largely unknown to Stevie's parents. They only knew that David had completed high school off campus and that he was doing some kind of internship or work study somewhere. All that mattered was that Stevie had a boyfriend. The perfect boyfriend in their eyes. And therefore, she had completed her mission. It was the most infuriating thing that had ever happened, and it made Stevie want to scream all the time. But she also wanted to maintain this weird peace that had been established so that she could get back to Ellingham in the fall and then to college after that. But what then? She had gotten in with the stated purpose of solving the Ellingham case. She'd done that. It was impossible, but she'd done it. What do you do for your next act after that? What would she study? Where would she go from there? It hit her every night, this weird emptiness, usually as she unclicked her seatbelt and got out of the car, still smelling of grocery store, deli department, biting her tongue so that she didn't snap at her mom about the boyfriend thing. As she climbed into bed, Stevie thumbed through her messages. Right after the Ellingham case broke, she had gotten many of them. Media requests, strange influencer offers. We think you'd be a great fit to promote our paleo meal kits. Creepers, and people who wanted her to help find their lost relatives or dogs. The media requests had been okay, but they had petered out. The bizarre influencer offers had stopped. Stevie had sympathy for people who had missing relatives or dogs, but usually there was nothing that could be done from a distance. So really, it was just the creepers now. They were loyal. Tonight, there was one note about a lost cat, two messages that said hi and nothing else, and a random picture of a teddy bear holding a heart. But right in the middle, there was a subject line that stood out.
Camp Wonder Falls. There was only one Camp Wonder Falls. Well, that probably wasn't true. There might be a lot of places called Camp Wonder Falls, but there was one Camp Wonder Falls that was related to true crime. She opened the message.
Stevie, my name is Carson Buchwald, and I am the owner and founder of Box Box. You've probably heard of it. I've recently purchased a camp in western Massachusetts called Camp Sunny Pines. It used to be called Camp Wonder Falls. Yeah, that Camp Wonder Falls. I am making a true crime podcast/documentary about the Box in the Woods murders. I read about what you did at Ellingham Academy. I like to think outside the box, which is ironic, I know, because I run Box Box. Stevie frowned at the screen. And I thought of you right away. How would you like to come and work here this summer and look into the case with me? You could be a counselor at the camp, but mostly you could do what you need to do to look into the case. I can provide you with travel funds and pay you for your time. You can bring friends if that sweetens the deal. It's a camp. There's plenty of room. If you're interested, get back in touch with me. I hope to hear from you. Carson Buchwald, CEO and founder, Box Box. It's what's inside that counts. Well, this was a development.
July 7th, 1978, 7:30 a.m. The morning's PA blast rattled through the trees, stirring the birds.
Good morning, Camp Wonder Falls. Welcome to another beautiful day.
Brandy Clark shoved her face into her pillow and pressed it against her ears, trying to block out the announcement, the light, the birds, the sound of 10 kids waking and laughing. Too soon. Too much morning. Just a little more sleep, please. Brandy had been up 5 times during the night with Claire Parsons. Claire was 8 and scared of going to the bathroom by herself. The bathroom was outside, about 30 feet away from the cabin. And Claire had to pee more than any child alive. Brandy had tried everything. Cutting off Claire's supply of bug juice after dinner, taking Claire to the bathroom 3 times before lights out, offering to give Claire something to pee into on the cabin porch so she wouldn't have to go out to the toilets. If you told Claire to go by herself, she would stand by your cot and poke you with a wet finger until you took her. Why was it always wet? From what? Usually, Brandy split this duty with her fellow counselor, Diane McClure. But Diane had never come back from her midnight rendezvous with her boyfriend. We're going to have a beer and a smoke, Diane had said the evening before. I'll be back by 2, promise.
Sure. This morning we have pancakes in the dining pavilion, and it's softball day, so everyone let's get up and at 'em.
Shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, Brandy mumbled into the pillow. Shut up and die, shut up and die.
What? Brandy turned and looked up to see Bridget Lord, another one of her campers, standing right next to her. The campers slept in the main part of the cabin. The counselors had a little privacy in the form of a plywood half wall. The campers weren't supposed to cross this boundary unless they needed something. Most of them followed this rule, but not Bridget. Bridget was a natural narc with a nose for trouble, and she would quite literally get in your face to find out what was going on.
Where's Diane? Bridget asked.
I don't know, Brandy said, rubbing her eyes.
Did she stay out all night?
As much as Brandy was annoyed at Diane right now, there was still a code around here. You didn't rat on the other counselors. If you wanted to go to the woods for private time, or skip out on a bunk inspection, or cut a few corners with any of the rules, everyone else would look out for you.
No, Brandy replied, pushing herself out of her cot. She probably went to get an early shower.
Why?
More hot water, I don't know.
I didn't hear her get up, Bridget said.
So, do you hear everything?
Kind of. One time I heard my sister smoking in the garage, and I was in my room.
Brandy believed it. Bridget was terrifying.
Well, you didn't hear her. Get your stuff. Come on, shower time.
Bridget narrowed her eyes. She could smell Brandy's cover-up,
But there was nothing she could do about it because she was 8, and being 8 sucks. You have no power. Someday, Bridget would have her revenge. The world would know her rage. Brandy abandoned hope of a blissful 5 or 10 extra minutes and shuffled into the main part of the cabin, not bothering to put on her flip-flops. The campers were all crawling out of bed. She made sure they had their bath caddies and towels and that they were all moving in the direction of the bathrooms.
"Where's Diane?"
Bridget asked again, tagging along beside Brandy as they all got in line.
"I told you, she got up early."
"And went where? She's not in the showers. I looked for her stuff."
"Bridget, can you stop?"
She was going to kill Diane and Todd. Those idiots were going to ruin it for everyone. Little Claire was the first one into the bathroom. She may have been a midnight peer, but she was mercifully quick in the shower. There was no way she washed. She just turned the water on and off. Brandy knew this, but did not actually care. Little kids were filthy. You accepted it, and you moved on. She ran out merrily in her little terry cloth robe. In daylight, Claire was all butterflies and rainbows. She sang to herself and spun and skipped toward the edge of the woods. She reappeared seconds later and hurried back to Brandy.
"Someone's asleep on the path," she said.
This was all Brandy needed. One of her friends passed out in the dirt.
"They're all sticky," Claire added.
Great. Super great. Working alone? Check. Cleaning vomit off a passed out person before even waking up completely? Perfect.
"Where?"
Bridget asked, whipping around toward Claire. Claire pointed toward the path. Bridget tore off in that direction, her whole demeanor screaming, "J'accuse!" Brandy trailed behind her. This morning was the worst. Beyond the cabins and the bathrooms, there was a parting of the woods and a slender dirt path that snaked back toward the archery grounds and the structure that was generously referred to as the open-air theater. A few yards up the path, there was a figure fast asleep, face down in the dirt.
"That's not Diane," Bridget said, her voice dripping with disappointment.
Bridget was right. The figure on the ground wasn't Diane. It was a guy with a head of blonde curly hair. That and the red jersey t-shirt told Brandy it was Eric Wilde.
"What's wrong with him?" Bridget asked.
"Go brush your teeth, Bridget," Brandy said.
"I want to see
Bridget."
Bridget narrowed her eyes but backed up as directed. Brandy continued down the dirt path. She could see now why Claire had said he was sticky. There was something darkening the dirt all around him, some explosion of bodily emissions. This was going to be a bad one. That it was Eric was at least less trouble. She would be obligated to cover for Diane, help her shower. That was what bunkmates did. With Eric, though, the obligations were less arduous. Just shake him awake and get him moving. Not her problem after that.
"Eric, you moron," she called, stumbling down the dirt track in her bare feet. "What the hell?"
Eric didn't stir. Now that she was closer, Brandy could tell something was off about his position. He'd fallen face down, his arms and legs extended like he was in Superman position. Such a weird way to fall. His vomit, or whatever it was, dribbled all down the path to where he had landed and pooled out around him. The underside of his skin was faintly purple, and there was something wrong with his hair. It was darker than it should have been.
"Wake up,"
Brandy said, coming up to the unconscious figure and kneeling down.
"Eric, come on."
His stillness was unnatural. He made no sound. There was only the soft bird song and the sound of the trees and the chatter of the camp as it woke.
"Eric,"
she said. She rolled him over. Someone was screaming. It took her a moment to realize it was her.
2. The next morning, Stevie planted herself at the kitchen table with a bowl of cereal and an Ellingham library book that she had been permitted to take home for the summer. This was one of the many perks of Ellingham, and of being on good terms with Kyoko, the school librarian, who had specially ordered it for her.
"What's that you're reading?"
her mother said as she passed behind Stevie. She paused, leaning in to look, as Stevie knew she would.
Is that a dollhouse?
Sort of, Stevie said, flipping the page. Her mother made a noise that sounded like a hamster being gently but persistently pressed until flattened. The scene depicted was a kitchen lovingly crafted in miniature. The walls were papered in a cheerful pattern of deer and flowers. There was ironing on the small board, a pot in the sink, two potatoes on the draining board, each no bigger than a child's pinky nail. From the curtains to the line outside the window pegged with bras and stockings, to the pile of folded linens, everything about this scene was made with care. This included the unmistakably dead figure on the floor by the oven, a doll-size ice tray under her hand. It's called The Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death, Stevie said. They're dioramas made in the 30s and 40s to teach investigators how to look at crime scenes. This one is called Kitchen. Look at the incredible level of detail. See these tiny cans on the shelves? Those labels are accurate reproductions. See the carefully printed tiny newspapers stuffed in the cracks of the doors? And all these doors have tiny functioning keys. Everything in this scene has been made and put in here to be examined. It all means something. Did the woman stuff the paper in the door herself to gas herself? You can tell it's gas for sure. The jets are open on the stove and her skin has been painted so you can see the blush you get from carbon monoxide poisoning. But did she do it herself or did someone knock her out, then stuff the paper in the doors and leave her in there? See, she's in the middle of taking things out of the oven. Her mother stared at Stevie grimly. The woman who made these was named Frances Glessner Lee, Stevie went on. It used to be that when someone died, there was no set method for examining the body and the scene. All kinds of people would be sent who had no formal training, and they'd move things, or they'd guess at what happened, or they'd contaminate the scene. Sometimes people would be accused of murder when it was an accident, and the other way around. So this woman... Stevie flipped to the photo of the grandmotherly woman with the old-fashioned glasses and bun, who was peering lovingly into a skull. Was the heiress to a tractor fortune, and she was friends with the chief medical examiner in Boston. He told her about all the trouble he was having with how bodies and scenes were being treated, and all of the things you could learn about a death from the scene and the body. She basically established forensics in the United States. Then she made these miniatures, each depicting an unexplained death. Each one is a contained mystery. They still use them to train detectives. Her mother walked over to the counter, shaking her head. Stevie observed her surreptitiously. I wish you'd get another hobby, but... The sentence was left unfinished. Stevie flipped back to the kitchen scene and let a few moments tick by while she waited for her mother to speak again. What are you up to this afternoon?
I was going to read, Stevie said.
It's a gorgeous day. You could get some sun.
Stevie hmmed and leaned in close to the picture of the death kitchen. I got a note, she said casually, from a guy who owns a summer camp. He read about me, what I did at Ellingham. He asked if I wanted a job working there as a counselor. I guess he thought I'd be an interesting addition, you know, something extra for campers.
A summer camp? Stevie's mom said.
You?
I know, Stevie said, right?
Stevie had never precisely been the outdoor type. They had camped once as a family when Stevie was 12, and the neighbors down the street invited them to come on a week's trip to a state park. Stevie spent most of the week huddled under their RV awning trying to read, while her parents and the other family drank iced teas and beers and talked about television shows and what was wrong with America. No one could swim in the lake because apparently there was some kind of brain-eating bacteria in it. Periodically, someone would encourage her to walk through the woods or try out the mountain bike. Stevie viewed these offers with grave suspicion and declined. Stevie couldn't listen to anything or talk to anyone because her parents had taken her phone in order for her to experience some offline time, which she had been anyway because they were in the middle of nowhere with no real signal and no Wi-Fi. Camping sucked. Stevie flipped to another part of the book slowly, to an even more graphic image. This is the most elaborate of the nutshell studies, she said. It's called three-room dwelling. Three rooms, three bodies. What's key in this one is the blood splatter. Where is this camp?
Somewhere in Massachusetts, Stevie said, Looks pretty, I guess. He even said I could bring my friends.
Look at the blood on this blanket here.
What's it called?
What?
Stevie said.
The camp, what's it called?
Oh, Sunny something. Sunny Oaks, some kind of tree. Wait, I looked it up on my phone last night.
This was a careful calculation. Her parents had probably never heard of the Camp Wonderfalls murders, and the Sunny Pines website certainly didn't advertise the connection, but she couldn't risk them Googling it. She had it primed and ready to go. Her mother looked at Stevie's phone while Stevie continued her contemplation of the blood splatter on the tiny kitchen floor.
It looks nice, her mother said.
It did. Stevie had examined the site in detail. It was image after image of trees, kids leaping off a platform into a lake, kids playing instruments and making crafts, bonfires, cookouts, and toasting marshmallows.
And they said you could bring friends? Her mom asked.
Uh-huh.
Stevie flipped to another part of the book, to an attic scene that featured a hanging.
And this is a real offer?
Her mom said, eyeing the pictures.
From the real owner?
Yep.
Let me see it.
Stevie blinked, as if this request was a surprise.
Oh, she said.
Sure, I guess.
Stevie reached for her phone and pulled up a message, then passed it back to her mom.
Stevie, my name is Carson Buchwald, and I am the owner and founder of BoxBox. You've probably heard of it. I also own a summer camp in western Massachusetts called Camp Sunny Pines. I read an article about what you did at Ellingham Academy, and I thought it was incredible. How would you like to come and work here this summer? You could be a counselor. I think it would be great to have someone like you on our staff. Our camp is in some beautiful woods. We have a swimming lake, falls, and a great little town nearby with some of the best ice cream in the country. It's a fantastic place with great kids. You are welcome to bring friends if that sweetens the deal. If you're interested, get back in touch with me. I hope to hear from you. Carson Buchwald, CEO and founder, BoxBox. It's what's inside that counts.
This sounds great, her mom said. Wouldn't you rather do this than work in a supermarket and read books about murder dollhouses?
That seems like a lot of outside, Stevie said.
Outside is good. You could use some sun.
Skin cancer, Stevie said. Besides, I want to get a lot of reading done this summer, and there's a free online course in forensic pathology starting in a week.
Stevie, her mom said. Don't you want to be social? Wouldn't you like to be with your friends?
Stevie made a show of considering this point.
I guess, she said after a long moment. I'll think about it.
This little piece of magic had been achieved with relative ease. She had recently been reading about Charles Manson, who used many popular persuasion techniques in order to form his murderous cult. One tip he had picked up from a popular self-help book was, make the other guy think the idea is his. Stevie wanted nothing to do with Charles Manson's personal philosophy, but this passed along tidbit was very useful and, it appeared, effective. The only thing worse than saying, I want to go work at a murder camp, was probably, I have been studying the persuasive techniques of Charles Manson. So this was one she was keeping to herself. The new email from Carson was real. She had written back to him immediately the night before.
Carson, I am very interested, but I can promise you this. My parents are never going to let me go if they think this is about investigating a murder. Could you write another note about how this is all about camping and doing healthy outdoor stuff? Stevie.
She had no idea if he'd go for it, but it turned out he did. The squeaky clean new email had arrived with astonishing speed. All Stevie had to do then was prop herself up with her murder dollhouse book in the morning and wait. By mid-afternoon, the matter was settled. Stevie Bell was going to be a camp counselor at the most notorious camp in America. More important, she was back on a case.
July 7th, 1978, 7:30 a.m. Susan Marks was proud of her clipboard wall. There were 26 clipboards in all, hung from little screw-in hooks that she had put in herself 5 years ago,
when she started running the camp. From this command center, she made order out of chaos, organized hundreds of children and dozens of teenagers. There was a section for everything. Clipboards for every bunk, listing campers, counselors, contact numbers, known allergies. Another line of clipboards listed the activities for every week of the camp, which led to a different section of clipboards that broke down activities for every day. For most of the year, Susan Marks ran the physical education and health department at Liberty High. During the summer, she ran the camp, and the job suited her very well. She woke early, when the camp was still asleep, and took a quick 7-mile run. She began on the campsite, running around the lake, then crossing over the dirt road that separated Camp Wonder Falls from the public campground on the other side. She continued her way around the lake there, where the paths were more rugged and rocky and the incline steeper. She went quietly past the tents full of sleeping tourists and waved to the fishermen setting out in their little boats. Up, 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 working hard now as she ascended the hill at the far end of the lake. Here, the path left the lake edge and wound through the trees. Once she made it to the top at the far end, she would pause at Arrowhead Point to catch her breath. The spot was so named because it resembled an arrowhead of dark stone, jutting 70 feet above the lake. It was the best view you could ever hope to see. Below, Lake Wonder Falls stretched out, reflecting back the early sun. There was nothing like seeing dawn break from up here. After this moment of reflection, it was an easy trip downhill and back over to her cabin at Camp Wonder Falls for a quick, cold shower. At 7:30 exactly, she picked up the clipboard with that day's activities and switched on the loudspeaker. "Good morning, Camp Wonder Falls," she said. "Welcome to another beautiful day." She meant it, too. The runner's high stayed with her for a while. "This morning we have," a quick glance at the clipboard that read menus, "pancakes in the dining pavilion, and it's softball day, so everyone let's get up and at 'em." She switched off the loudspeaker and ticked announcement off the daily to-do checklist. Even if you knew your routine like the back of your hand, a checklist was still important. She ran down the rest of the day. The local stable was coming by and bringing 5 horses for riding lessons. There was a water safety test. Cabin 12 had developed a leak in the roof. Someone was taking a canoe out at night, and she needed to find out who it was. And some other joker had put a snake in the girls' changing rooms at the junior pool. She would start by calling the stable and... Then there was a scream. A single, unbroken scream. Screaming was common at the camp. Campers screamed when they swam and played, and sometimes simply for the sake of screaming. But this scream had a high, clear ring to it, and it did not break for almost 10 seconds. It lingered over the water before it sounded again, this time louder, more insistent. She had never heard its equal. Not when Penny Mattis almost drowned in the lake, or when that counselor a few years back fell out of a tree. Susan did not hesitate. She grabbed her walkie-talkie from its charging base as she went to the small porch of her cabin to survey the camp. It was impossible to know exactly where the scream had come from, but it was certainly on the other side of the lake, from the direction of the cabins. Her walkie crackled to life. "Susan, did you hear that?" It was Magda McMurphy, the camp nurse. "Yes, not sure where it came from." Susan was moving quickly toward the footbridge. "I think it was over toward the edge of the woods, over by archery." The scream came once more, and it stirred the whole camp. "I don't like the sound of that," Magda said. "I'll meet you over there with my bag." It didn't take Susan long to locate the source of the scream. The camp had all turned in its direction, many moving toward it. She made her way through, encouraging people to go back to what they were doing as she went. When she reached the edge of the woods, she found one of the younger campers, Claire Parsons, standing outside of her cabin in her little terry cloth robe. She looked up at Susan and pointed toward the path into the woods.
"She went that way," Claire said.
"Who did?"
"Brandy."
"Go inside and get dressed, Claire.
Susan said as she hurried off.
He's asleep.
Susan had no time to try to work out what that meant. She moved faster. Behind her, there was the sound of a bicycle. Magda skidded up, hopping off the bike and then dropping it on the grass. Before them, the path bent gently to the left, going deeper into the woods, toward the camp's theater and archery range. They came upon a strangely calm scene. Brandy Clark, one of Susan's most reliable counselors, was kneeling on the ground, looking straight ahead. In front of her, maybe 20 feet or so, there was a figure on the path. Susan recognized the curly head of hair at once, Eric Wilde.
He's there,
Brandy said, sounding sleepy and distant.
I put him back.
Again, this made no sense. No time for questions. Susan and Magda continued on. Eric was face down in the dirt like he was taking a nap. His shirt was mottled, ragged. There was something wrong with his hair. Eric was blonde, but this hair was much too dark in places. But the most telling thing? The flies. All the flies buzzing around, landing in groups. Magda made an odd noise, like a hissing tire, and broke into a run. She dropped down on the ground next to Eric and pressed her fingers to his wrist.
He's cold, Magda said. I'll call an ambulance. No point. He's gone.